All right, it is the 11th of November, and this is the privacy class, and we're talking about health information. First things first, I know there's going to be some concern, we're in November, about what's going to be on the exam, which I'm still pondering, for what you're responsible. The short answer is, you're responsible for what we discuss in class. If there is reading material I refer to in class as you having had read, you should have read it. If there's a chapter that I've posted by exam prep time, I expect you to read it. There are going to be, sometimes I refer to some cases, like tonight I actually refer to some cases. You don't need to know more about them than we discuss. This will be an open materials exam. We will have review. So you shouldn't be concerned. I'm not going to expect you to know more than I've taught you or I've given you to read. Really. I'm not out to get anybody. My goal is to evaluate whether you have understood our discussion and the ideas that I'm putting across. So if you haven't, let me know. But that's what we're talking about. Okay. Questions on that? All right. This has been and continues to be a busy week for privacy generally. This evening, or rather this afternoon, it was announced that Facebook and the Federal Trade Commission are coming to apparent settlement on privacy issues. This, what the apparent settlement is going to be, it says we're going to have audits for 20 years. It would prohibit Facebook from making public a piece of information that a user had originally shared privately on the site without express permission. And I've also read reports that say that Facebook's privacy settings will be switched to opt-in rather than opt-out. However, to say that Facebook would be prohibited from making public a piece of information that a user had originally shared privately is, of course, nonsense. Why is that nonsense? Why is that a useless prohibition? Is it Facebook that shares things? If you post something to your wall, and it's private to your friends, and one of your friends copies it and pastes it into a public wall posting, why, that is a piece of information that the user had originally shared privately on the site that is now being made public. And what does that mean? I mean, we'll have to see what the settlement is like, but once again, we get to this issue where the service provider has a certain amount of control, but it cannot promise to do something it is unable to do. Facebook cannot prevent private information from being shared through its service. It just has to be copied and pasted. It may not undo privacy settings on a particular file, but beyond that, that's not really helpful. So we'll have to see what this says. Another article from today. There's a survey coming out of London that says that while mobile users want privacy, 75% don't even take the minimal measures necessary to prevent their privacy being breached. They don't read the terms and conditions of mobile applications, which may be accessing their physical information, but they don't consider it. Here's one that came out about two hours ago. When it says 2 hours ago, that was 2 hours ago. I just grabbed this as I'm prepping for class. Any one of you have a Steam game playing account? Good, because otherwise I'd say stop now and change your password. Apparently Steam has been... I started on time for once. I know it's kind of a novelty. No, you're apologizing to me? Hardly. You can be sorry, but no apologies are allowed. So, latest data breach. Credit card numbers and personal information, apparently, from the Steam game playing service. Something I need to deal with my kids when I get home, because I don't know what they've done in terms of Steam memberships and payments. Anybody see this yesterday? Talking about health? This was an editorial in yesterday's New York Times. A very idealistic editorial. Our high-tech healthcare future. And how do we improve healthcare in our high-tech future? By eliminating doctors, of course. Here's a picture of how it could work, writes the editorial. It would begin with a digital nervous system, inconspicuous wireless sensors worn on your body, placed in your home, that would continually monitor your vital signs and track the daily activities that affect your health, counting the steps, number of steps you take, and the quantity and quality of food you eat. Wristbands would measure your levels of arousal, attention, and anxiety. Bandages would monitor cuts for infection. Your bathroom mirror would calculate your heart rate, blood pressure, and oxygen level. Then you'd get automated advice. Software that could analyze and visually represent this data would enable you to truly understand the impact of your behavior on your health and suggest changes to help prevent illness. By far the most effective way to cut healthcare costs. Oh, if you weren't well, you could a lifelike avatar on your smartphone would use natural language processing to listen as you describe your symptoms. You might slip a low-cost plastic attachment over your phone display, look into its eyepiece, and conduct a cataract exam. Anyone hearing, you know, the Jetsons going like... Okay. Note the... I love the disclosure. I'm an advisor to some early-stage startups developing technologies like these. This is wonderful! Siri, you've all heard about, anyone have an iPhone with iOS 5 on it? With this new Siri thing? Siri, can you find me the nearest McDonald's? No. And perhaps you should eat somewhere more healthy because your cholesterol is up. And by the way, I've told your life insurance company that you lied when you said you hadn't smoked in 6 years. And they've raised your rates. Consider the amount of data that must be collected to get us into this high-tech medical future. And where it's living, the data that is, where they're living, who and what kind of entities have access to them, what they're going to do with them. Troubling? Not if you don't listen to your phone more often. And because things are constantly changing, it's almost a good thing we didn't discuss health privacy last week. Why? Because yesterday afternoon, we had a hearing in the Senate, Your Health and Privacy. Protecting health information in a digital world. Let's see if we can see Senator Franken here. Chairman Franken presiding. Let's go a little. Get some introductory statements.
Required healthcare from.
Hold on.
In August of June.
Can we just get the introduction, please?
To tell your doctor when you're.
All right, hold on, Mr. Senator Franken. Oh, we're gaveled.
This hearing of the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law will be called to order. This is our subcommittee's second hearing, and this one will focus on the important issue of health privacy.
Thank you.
Two decades, an incredible thing has happened. You can now put your entire medical history need to get all the benefits of electronic health records while still protecting the extraordinarily sensitive information that they contain. I believe all Americans have a fundamental right to know who has their personal information and to control who gets that information and with whom it is shared. I also think that welcoming the ranking member, Senator Coburn, good afternoon. It is morning in Oklahoma, let the record show that. Good morning. I also think that our fundamental right to privacy includes the right to know that our sensitive information, wherever it is safe and secure. And unfortunately, breach after breach of health data has shown us that when it comes to health information, our right to privacy is not being fully protected. On the evening of July 28, 2011, a laptop was stolen from the backseat of the consultant's car in the Seven Corners neighborhood in Minneapolis. That laptop contained the names, dates of birth, social security numbers, and medical information for approximately 14,000 patients of Fairview Health Services, and the names and medical information for another 2,800 patients of the North Memorial Medical Center. Those hospitals had told the consultant to encrypt that data. The consultant didn't do that, and it wasn't encrypted. Sadly, that was the third incident in about a year where the health data of Minnesotans was put at risk as a result of a laptop theft. In fact, since the collection of breach records started in 2009, 91 laptops containing the health information of approximately 1.8 million people have been lost or stolen. That's just a subset of a total of 364 major breaches since 2009 that have resulted in the breach of health data of over 18 million Americans. And this has been happening since far before 2009.
It goes on, obviously, and would be worth listening to, looking at, to see how that discussion goes. But happily, Senator Franken really encapsulated this discussion right there. On the one hand, health information is literally crucial for saving lives. Access by doctors, by other healthcare professionals, by pharmacists, EMTs, to complete records, information that patients may not even know or may not report accurately or may not be conscious or competent enough to report, can make the difference between life and death. And digitally recording those data, sorting them, of making them available significantly improves the efficiency of the process. We heard from this HCMC example. First two doctors followed the rules, or the procedure was put it on paper. They looked around themselves, saw how many patients they had. We have the electronic records. They're faster. Let's switch. And they did. But on the other hand, once data are stored electronically on a thumb drive, like this one, I don't remember how many gigabytes I'm carrying around, right? Or on a laptop, or on a network, they're subject to breach, to theft, to misuse. Or, and even if it's not misuse, the more parties have easy access to them, the easier it is for them to say, oh, the data are there, why don't you share them with us? The more those pieces of information may be used in ways that are not improving the patient's health, but may in fact be based on the economic interests of someone who is not involved in the patient's health. like an insurance company or an employer. We have today the cases are personal injury case where someone claims an injury but posts a picture on Facebook that shows he or she is not injured. Or someone says, the case that I keep citing to in talking about social media privacy of the lawyer who needed that 1 week continuance and then posted pictures of for a family funeral and then posted pictures of or describing how he was going out drinking, et cetera, and going on motorbiking. Consider, though, calling in sick at work when these data are available, when your employer potentially could check or could hire someone to check you out. Claim to be sick, claim to have the flu. Really? You don't sound so sick. Check your temperature, let's see. You know, put your phone up to your ear or listen to your heartbeat or whatever. The misuse issues are real. So, as I said, I'm going to mention some cases as well tonight. I know you haven't read them because I haven't presented them to you. I'm letting you know at least what they are, what they're about. They are major cases. They'll be in the PowerPoints. You are encouraged to read them to have a better understanding of the background issues. But they're just part of this overall discussion. So these kind of issues we're talking about here, generally the data, confidentiality of the information, how that is driven by medical ethics and court privileges, the liability of physicians or health providers for disclosing patient information or failing to, because of reporting requirements, and some other protections. HIPAA comes into this. I mentioned at the beginning of the semester what happens here. When health insurance was told to make itself portable. In the mid-90s, 1996, Congress directed changes to how health providers and insurance companies tracked information in order to make it interoperable and easily portable. That's the P. Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Portability requires standardized data formats, and electronic storage to make it easy to transfer records from one insurer to another, from one doctor to another, from one employer to another. But in doing so, Congress was supposed to be passing laws, and then we got regulations with regard to protecting those data. There are certain constitutional protections of medical information we'll discuss tonight. And then we're going to get into a bit of an esoteric issue. Not just about health records, but literally the data that make up each of us. Genetic information. That data storage. Who is entitled to access it and for what purposes? All right. Some quick words on the issues of ethics and privilege. First rule of medicine is? Bill. No, that's lawyering. No. Part of the oath of Hippocrates, in addition to doing no harm and not incidentally refusing to perform abortions, which is in fact part of the oath of Hippocrates, whatever in connection with my professional life service or not in connection with it, I see or hear in the life of men, which ought not to be spoken of abroad, I will not divulge, as reckoning that all such should be kept secret. So even back to the days of Hippocrates the physician, the idea that discretion was part of the practice or should be part of the practice of medicine was embedded. We have our regulations, we have our ethical rules, so do doctors. Information is confidential to the greatest possible degree. The physician should not reveal confidential communications or information without the express consent of the patient unless required to do so by law. Well, when does the law require it? When does the law prohibit it? We know what a privilege is, right? What's a privilege? It's the thing that one is born to with a silver spoon in one's mouth. What's a privilege? What does this mean? When does a privilege get invoked? In what context?
Trial.
Trial or other legal proceedings. And what is the privilege? What does a privilege do? What does it do with a piece of information?
Protects it.
What? How? From what?
Make it public.
Is it a question of public or private? We're talking about a judicial legal proceeding. What do we have to... Even if something is known, is it always usable? What do we call it when something isn't usable in a court? Inadmissible. Not so much an irrelevance thing, but admissibility. This is where you have to differentiate between, for example, the obligation of an attorney to keep things confidential and the attorney-client privilege. Whether or not you ever show up in a courtroom, you as an attorney have an obligation, an almost absolute obligation, to keep information from and about your client confidential. But the attorney-client privilege means that certain types of information, communications with regard to the legal representation, may not be admitted in court, may not be considered as evidence by the finder of fact. Even if they become disclosed, they're not usable. That's what a privilege is. And which party controls the attorney-client privilege? Who has the ability to waive it? The client. It is a nice thing, I will point out parenthetically. The attorney-client privilege is a wonderful thing for us as lawyers because it means that we are rarely, if ever, called to the stand. Trust me on this one. I was in-house, I think I've mentioned perhaps before, at a company that was undergoing a spectacular and questionable-looking bankruptcy. It was a company whose business model was so flawed, I was hired after the flaws were long since embedded, so flawed that it looked like a Ponzi scheme. It wasn't. But it had the economics of a Ponzi scheme without the intent to defraud. It was just a company whose cash flow was so poor and whose business model was so screwed up that upon the bankruptcy, there were criminal investigations begun and various lawsuits. And lots of people within this rather small company were being called to testify. Some were retaining counsel of their own. And I was very, very happily essentially immune because my role was purely as a lawyer. I was not entitled to testify about anything because the attorney-client privilege meant what I would say wasn't admissible. It's a nice thing. But the attorney-client privilege is not the only privilege that we have. Before I go down the list, anybody know of others? Spousal, okay. Any others? Doctor patients going to come up tonight, of course. Any others? Clergy, priest, penitent, they call it. There are two kinds of spousal privileges. A spouse may not be required to testify, and a spouse may not be permitted may not disclose spousal communications. Accountant-client privilege, priest-penitent, means someone who's sorry. Physician-patient, voter privilege, may not be compelled to disclose, to testify as to for whom. Journalistic privileges, shield laws and the like, not being obligated to disclose sources. Executive privilege, not of business executives, but of the executive branch, and so on. Now, at their heart, setting aside perhaps, let's see, spousal privilege, let's maybe set that aside for a little bit. What about the attorney, the accountant, the priest, penitent, and the physician patient? What's the common thread there? Why are communications with attorneys, accountants, clergy people, and doctors privileged? Why do you want to? Why does society want you to?
Because it's, in the case of the attorney and the doctor, they need to be able to help you the best they can if you're not telling them everything.
And the same is true of an accountant, right? Giving you financial advice, giving you financial services is difficult if you're not being told everything about the person's finances. Priest penitent, it goes back, but confession is good for the soul. And society apparently wants to preserve that relationship. And the others really are foundational. Without them, marital relationships might not work as well. Certainly we wouldn't get anything from like The Sopranos on TV. Journalists might not be able to inform as well if every source was going to be identified. Votes would not be as reliable if one's voting record could be made public. And at least arguably, government officials would not feel confident doing things with regard to national security if their conversations could then be disclosed. So we have these privileges, and they each have their limitations, their understanding, their equivalents in state and federal courts, etc. And then they can be potentially expanded depending on the court and the circumstances, like a parent-child privilege. Here is one that really does come up. Psychotherapist, patient privilege. Now, a psychiatrist is covered by the canons, right? As a licensed physician, a psychiatrist fits in here. But what about a psychologist? What about a clinical social worker? The roles of people who are providing mental health services, right? The type of role for mental health services has expanded dramatically in the last 100+ years. Right? Every week we read the Touro Times. Every week there's a little blurb at the end. What does it say? Jennifer Snow, right, is available if you have problems. Anyone have the Touro Times handy? She's not a psychiatrist. She is, I think, a clinical psychologist. She may be a clinical social worker. And I'm not even sure I've ever met her. And I'm thrilled that she is available to you. But understand, we don't have a psychiatrist on staff. But the clear implication is you should, as students, feel free to come to her with problems. Help you with them. But if society values those services and has expanded the roles of the people entitled to provide them, what happens to the privilege? Wouldn't failing to extend the privilege to non-physicians make those other services less effective? Come tell your problems to me. Oh, but I'm not I didn't go to medical school, so I may have to talk about them in court. Wait, where are you going? So, what is important to remember, too, is that unlike at least the New York version of our ethics obligations, there are mandated disclosures for health professionals. Things that they mustn't, that they may not keep confidential. Anybody know about these things? Child abuse. Absolutely. Spousal abuse. If Joe Paterno had been the team's psychologist, he would have probably had a mandated reporting requirement. If he had been a teacher, he might well have. Not sure about university teachers because it doesn't generally come up. Sexually transmitted diseases must be reported. Bullet wounds often must be reported. So whether or not there's a privilege, whether or not there's an obligation of confidentiality, these particular circumstances outweigh those. They overrule them. So we have some of these cases, which again, I'm just going to mention, where you have a doctor sued for breach of confidentiality, and there the question is it the kind of matter where the patient has a cause of action? Are there damages? It may be a breach of ethics, but are there damages? Insurance companies that have access to this information, who are not themselves healthcare providers. Here we have Aetna held liable for a breach of confidentiality. The Tarasoff case and the McIntosh versus Milano case really get into the question of how far do we extend the privilege? Is a psychotherapist, and these cases involved violent crimes where the therapist may have had reason to know about it and didn't say anything. And whether there was no mandated reporting here, but then failing to disclose was potentially a cause of liability, and the defenses were not permitted to disclose. But we're not doctors. They weren't doctors. That is, they weren't physicians, MDs, or even DOs. Was the privilege going to be extended? And we have two state cases which discuss that. So those are the concepts. The general assumption is healthcare providers must keep patient information confidential. Healthcare providers may not be required to disclose that information, absent certain exceptions, because of the privilege. And, at least in some circumstances, the scope of those obligations and the scope of the privilege may extend beyond a traditional doctor physician to others involved in providing health care services. That's our foundation. Those are the concepts. And then we reach into health care. And so with the overall general requirement of confidentiality, and then the addition of the ease, the mandate of digital records, bringing with it the ease of sharing, misusing, losing, modifying, etc. So we got the HIPAA privacy rules, which I've introduced to you in the past. as of April 2003, and then a year later for the smaller ones, not only for health plans, healthcare clearinghouses, healthcare providers, but the companies, like consultants, that have access to the information by virtue of the business relationship. If you are doing IT services for a hospital, you are considered a business associate under HIPAA and are required by HIPAA to bring yourself under, by contract, these obligations. Or if you're a fundraiser or some of the other circumstances. So that's the concept of HIPAA. And as we heard from Senator Franken, in order to further incentivize this transition from analog, from paper to digital records, one of the elements of the stimulus package passed by Congress at the beginning of the Obama administration was this High-Tech Act, which then provided those incentives. Are you looking quizzical?
I read HIPAA Act, but I never read the High-Tech Act.
Right. So what High-Tech Act did, and that's what we heard from the esteemed senator, was the pace of transition was not necessarily as quick as Congress would like. That healthcare institutions and health plan providers were not moving as quickly to digital records and charting systems and the like. So we weren't yet gaining the efficiency benefits, the cost savings. So what the High-Tech Act does, essentially, is add carrots and a few sticks to try to make that more effective, and that transition faster. Gives out some money and also adds some additional requirements. But ultimately, it's extending the pace of that transition. So, in reading over HIPAA, and again, I want you to at least have skimmed it, looked at the summaries and skimmed through it to get a sense of the different categories, you'll see covered entities, which are the different kinds of companies and businesses and individuals who are the primary targets of HIPAA. Now, sometimes, by the way, you wouldn't necessarily consider certain. They're not only who you think they are and what you think they are. Consider big companies. Major corporations often self-insure. They have so many employees, and it would just be they don't want to necessarily hire, but they don't need to hire a health insurance provider. Instead, they will reimburse employees directly. Self-insurance. Well, guess what? If a company takes on the role of a self-insurer, even if the company makes cars or photocopiers, that company is now subject to HIPAA obligations, the same as Aetna would be, or Blue Cross Blue Shield, or Long Island, North Shore LIJ. So what you get, if your clients are considering being a self-insurer, they also have to remember HIPAA compliance. Benefits professionals within companies. People who help claims management have access to the health information. And these obligations fall on them too. So you have definitions of electronic processing, of hybrid entities, companies that are both healthcare and non-healthcare. Individually identifiable health information. This is one of the things that distinguishes HIPAA from many of the laws that we have looked at this semester, and that generally we're familiar, I hope, with the concept of individually, personally identifiable information. Remember that, right? Those pieces of data that by themselves or in connection with others will uniquely identify an individual. So what do you think individually identifiable health information is? Any ideas? Pete?
Information that identified certain health characteristics of an individual.
Sure. It is both a piece of health information about a condition, about a treatment, about something, and it is linked to a unique individual. For a hospital to say, we do 300 cancer surgeries a year, that's not individually identifiable health information. But if the hospital should say, we did cancer surgery on Fred Jones, that is. That's where you differentiate between anonymized and non-anonymized health information. So hospitals certainly would have the same kind of obligations with regard to personally identifiable information generally, but they also have access to health. Just as our financial services industry players, when we talked about finances, had financial information, personally identifiable financial information, de-identified information, from which the identity is stripped. Doesn't always work, though. I mean, in this context it may, but I hope you'll recall our discussion of the AOL search database, where the fact that names were not included didn't end up mattering. Now, how is it that you could potentially have de-identified health information that nevertheless identified people? Let's say it's talking about, let's pick something fairly rare, separation surgery for conjoined twins. The hospital releases records, doesn't provide the name. Doesn't matter. There can't be that many conjoined twins in a particular community served by that hospital. Or I'll give you an even more proven real-world information example. Almost 17 years ago, because he turned 17 on Tuesday, 16 and a half years ago, our then infant son was diagnosed with an extremely rare soft tissue cancer. So rare that it was the first case that Long Island Jewish Medical Center had ever seen, and even Memorial Sloan Kettering had only seen 3 pediatric cases ever. Unfortunately, my luck, well, he is fine, which is why I can talk about this in such terms. I was, you know, the odds were so against it, I almost felt like I should be playing the lottery at that point. But where does this story come from? So, this, you know, what happens when you get these unusual cases? They get shared. As it happens, we had a family friend who was studying radiology at the time. I think she was a Columbia Presbyterian in her residency. And she called us up because she knew what had happened. Because our case and the imaging from our son had been shared with her group. Now, they didn't share his name, but they didn't have to. She knew what was going on because she was a family friend. So the fact that it was de-identified in our case didn't matter to this particular doctor because she knew who the patient was. And it was sufficiently unusual. I've often thought about this. If a medical journal were to write about a case of a hemangiopericytoma in a 5-month-old infant, I can tell you who that is. Anyone who knows us can tell you who that is. Doesn't matter whether the name is on there or not. If it's rare enough, unique enough, you're going to have, you know, the de-identification will essentially be wasted. So, but there are, at least there's a point of a process. And for both research and other purposes, you can see where the release of these aggregated or de-identified records might be necessary or desired. Education, employment records, etc. So we have definitions about how that information is protected, definitions of consent, the role of marketing, other uses of the data. notice of privacy practices, which are, I would guess that the only privacy-related notice that is paid attention to less than a website's privacy policy is the HIPAA notice you get from a new doctor. Has anyone ever sat down to read the notice? No. Actually, I've noted, and I haven't said anything because I don't need to read it, that the last couple times the doctors have just given me the acknowledgement form. Right? I'm not looking to make trouble, but you could. Also, if you take a look at the waiver, information sharing waiver, and see how much of your information you are consenting to being shared with anyone, you know, not just for treatment purposes. It's fairly broad what they ask you to, but they do have to tell you. There are certain exceptions to liability for non-authorized uses and disclosures, and we're hearing what Senator Franken talked about, the laptop. That would be a non-authorized disclosure. Disclosures to law enforcement officials, privacy officials and contact persons, these are all definitions and enforcement. So let's quickly look at some of the enforcement issues. Here, this is not merely general privacy. Consumer privacy, which branch of the federal government has jurisdiction over issues of financial of consumer privacy? You guys know this? What? Who don't look at the screen. Generally speaking, which agency has jurisdiction over consumer privacy? FTC. Even in financial privacy, FTC has jurisdiction. Other agencies, such as the Securities Exchange Commission, must pass regulations, but FTC has enforcement. Not so with HIPAA. HIPAA, which if I haven't mentioned yet, has both privacy rules and security rules. Regulations about who and how, who may access the data and how, and regulations about how those data must be stored and put behind access restrictions in order to facilitate the privacy side. Unlike some of the other things we've looked at, BJ's Wholesaleware, you know, those cases where the FTC has said, you're not following industry standards. And we had some discussion in class over the appropriateness of enforcing non-existent standards or hypothetical ones. Here, the HIPAA security rules are specific as to the types of technological protections needed. So the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Health and Human Services is responsible for enforcing HIPAA. Makes sense. Why civil rights, though? How do we consider privacy? Right? In the constitutional sense, privacy is a civil right. Is a civil right. Whether you conceive of that, that's the answer. We're told. HHS's Office for Civil Rights is responsible for enforcing these security rules. And has done so since 2003. The security rule as of April 2005, with enforcement, notice this gap. HIPAA-covered entities were required to comply with the security rule beginning on April 20th, 2005. OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, became responsible for enforcing it on July 27th, 2009. Okay. So, has it been enforced? Why, yes. Yes, it has. So, let's see. Let's check out New York. from April 30th through of 2003, April 14th through December 31st of 2010, of all the cases in New York, 70% were resolved after intake and review, 12% no violation was found, 18% corrective action was obtained. All right, what does that mean, corrective action? What correction has happened? Let's find out. Enforcement highlights. Privacy rule enforcements as of... So, as of the date of this summary, which was October 6th, last month, HHS's OCR has investigated and resolved over 14,527 cases by requiring changes in privacy practices and other corrective actions by the covered entities. They've investigated complaints against national pharmacy chains, major medical centers, group health plans, hospital chains, and small provider offices. 7,548 cases, they found no violation. And the rest were not eligible cases because of jurisdiction or other procedural issues. So the most investigated areas are impermissible uses and disclosures of protected health information, lack of safeguards, lack of patient access, uses and disclosures of more than the minimum necessary, and complaints to the covered entities. The most, the organizations that are most, have most often had to correct things, private practices are first. Why do you think that is? Why do you think private practices show up first? Any thoughts? Why do you think they've had to correct things most often? What do they lack that a hospital or an outpatient facility or health plan or pharmacy might have? Money, personnel, technology. Think about your doctor. Maybe you go to doctors in sophisticated large practices, but if you don't, they're doing whatever it is they can. And whether through omission or commission, they have a lot of issues. For knowing disclosure or obtaining protected health information, it is not OCR, but the Department of Justice that has jurisdiction. They've made almost 500 referrals to the Department of Justice for these cases. So here's the security rule enforcement. For very many fewer, because it's a much shorter period, 2 years. Uh, 471 complaints. So we have numbers. Okay, so let's see some case examples and resolutions. Let's see, private practices. All right. Here's a case. Patient alleged that a covered entity failed to provide him access to his medical records. After OCR notified the entity of the allegation, the entity released the complainant's medical records but also billed him $100 for a records review fee. No. So that had to be refunded. So these kind of private practices. Safeguards for waiting rooms. A staff member of a medical practice discussed HIV testing procedures with a patient in the waiting room, therefore disclosing personal health information to several other individuals. Also, computer screens displaying patient information were easily visible to patients. In addition, OCR required the practice to reposition its computer monitors to prevent patients from viewing information on the screens, and the practice installed computer monitor privacy screens to prevent impermissible disclosures. Those can be nasty, I gotta say. One of my doctors had those And, you know, there are some that are really nicely designed. And you could, they're straight on, you can see them. You're slightly off, it's dark. The ones that these poor receptionists and billers had to deal with, you move to the side, they got blurry. Felt so badly for them because, you know, they leaned and they'd get, you know, couldn't have been comfortable. Here's one about a law firm. A pharmacy chain enters into a business associate agreement with a law firm. Complaint ad alleged that a law firm working on behalf of a pharmacy chain in an administrative proceeding, so it's not just IT people, impermissibly disclosed the personal health information of a customer of the pharmacy chain. OCR investigated the, so think about that. If that's true, well, it wouldn't be his client, but the attorney, the law firm, might be breaching confidentiality of information provided by a client. OCR investigated the allegations and found no evidence that the law firm had impermissibly disclosed the PHI, the customer's personal health information. However, the investigation revealed that the pharmacy chain and the law firm had not entered into a business associate agreement as required by the privacy rule to ensure the that personal health information is appropriately safeguarded. Without a properly executed agreement, a covered entity may not disclose personal health information to the law firm. To resolve the matter, the OCR required the pharmacy chain and the law firm to enter into a business associate agreement. What does that mean, folks? For you in practice. What is that saying about lawyers provide legal services to hospitals, to doctors, to pharmacies? What are we required to do beyond our standard retainer agreements? What? Not partners. We have to enter into a specific business associates agreement in the form and with the language required by the federal government before we are allowed to get information from our clients about their patients. But wait a minute, aren't we covered? Aren't we obligated anyway to keep information that we're given confidential? Isn't that what Rule 1.06 of the Rules of Attorney Responsibility says? Aren't we? Of course we are. Doesn't matter. This is not an obligation to keep things confidential. That's true. We have one. This is a procedural requirement before your client is entitled, is permitted to give you the information that you will then keep confidential. You see these type of things. Oh, this one. The joy of pseudoephedrine. You know what pseudoephedrine is? What's pseudoephedrine? What do we know? What brand name?
It's Sudafed.
It's Sudafed. Anyone buy this in the last few years? What do you got to do?
You have to give your ID.
Why?
They used to make crystal meth.
Yes, apparently. We weren't buying Sudafed and generic pseudoephedrine to clear up nasal congestion. We all have meth labs. Damn creative chemists getting
my way. I bought it twice in a 3-week stretch when I was really sick, and it actually came up flagged that I had bought it recently, and the pharmacist grilled me.
Yep.
And this was when I came in, I ended up being diagnosed with pneumonia, so I switched over to antibiotics, but I was sweating and coughing, and he grilled me for about 10 minutes before he would sell it.
Well, here's a case. A grocery store-based pharmacy chain maintained pseudoephedrine logbooks containing protected health information in a manner so that individual protected health information was visible to the public at the pharmacy counter. Initially, the pharmacy chain, which means, and it, this, you used to have to sign books. I know, right? Rite Aid, I used to go in when it was, wait, I have to track this back. When it was Eckerd, and then it was Genovese before Eckerd. It's always the same store. And you would buy pseudoephedrine, and they'd hand you the book, and you had to write, sign your name. But you could see all the people who signed it before you. So how was that personal health information? How was the... It says here, initially, the pharmacy chain refused to acknowledge the logbooks contained protected health information. How could you argue that it was, in fact, protected health information? What was in those logbooks? How did the pharmacist know to grill you for your second purchase in 3 weeks? Dominic? Because your name was in a record. Why was your name in the record? Because you bought it. Why did you buy it? Because you were sick. At least some of the people putting their names in the logbook were disclosing to the pharmacist that they had upper respiratory congestion. And by providing that information to others, by letting them see the logbook, that provider was sharing protected health information. Not for everyone necessarily, but for some of those purchasers. So that had to be changed. But you see all these different kinds of things that can happen. A pharmacy employee placed a customer's insurance card in another customer's prescription bag. The pharmacy did not consider the customer's insurance card to be protected health information. OCR clarified that an individual's health insurance card meets the statutory definition of personal health information and as such needs to be safeguarded. So you have all these different enforcement option things, right? And then you asked about the High Tech Act. So how is it? So in addition to providing these incentives, the High Tech Act requires Health and Human Services to provide for periodic audits to ensure covered entities and business associates are complying with HIPAA. To implement this mandate, OCR is piloting a program to perform up to 150 audits of covered entities. So that's the stick here. Yes, Congress is providing incentives, but Congress also wants to make sure that the previous requirements are being fulfilled. And so we have audits, and so on and so on. We have another rule, the Patient Safety and Quality Improvement Act. So we have patient safety work product privileges that apparently are related. So this is a good place to look at the HIPAA stuff, and I think I've given you guys links to this. We have the summary of the privacy rule, etc., and the security rule. HIPAA is not easy. Happily, we have even training materials. 40 slides of training materials just on protected health information that Health and Human Services put together. You could see all the fun stuff here. Worth looking at if you want to understand it better. Close all tabs, sure. That's when everything goes right. What about when things go horribly wrong, or may have gone horribly wrong? Caught this in a forum discussing mobile phones about 4 years ago now. Now, HIPAA being misspelled, remember, 1 P, 2 A's. Always important. I get very testy if I see HIPAA with 2 P's in an exam. Not as bad as Professor Shaw does if you misspell hearsay. But or talk about the privilege against self-incrimination, but I get testy. So here's what someone wrote. The problem is, and this past weekend, me and my girl were sending text messages through the day. All of a sudden, she advised me that she needed me to reboot my phone, which has happened before with other phones. Guess the message gets stuck in a loop. Anyway, later she shows me her phone. She has 15-plus messages in her phone from me, but they contained emails that I had in my inbox for Outlook. Now, I should let you know I work for an insurance company, and HIPAA violations are throwing red flags in my mind. I knew they were emails from my inbox because I compared them. Now the emails were all garbled up. I'm missing info. It's a... So, if I understand this person's writing, because he was accessing his work email on his cell phone, and because he was also texting his girlfriend on the self-same cell phone, and because he had access to personally identifiable health information because he worked at our insurance company, the technical glitch that may have taken his inbox and texted it to his girlfriend could have represented a HIPAA violation. Unintentional, to be sure. But that's when you start getting into these questions of how could it not happen? It's not even that he lost the phone. And happily, if you lose phones, most modern smartphones, you can wipe them remotely. And it wasn't that he accidentally forwarded the wrong email. If his story is to be understood, believed, his phone was basically taking stuff out of his inbox and texting it out. And because he had personally identifiable health information, it's a potential problem. I think we already showed you this story a few weeks ago when it broke, but I thought it was worth reiterating today. Stanford Hospital hired someone to do billing. The billing contractor put together a spreadsheet with patient information. The billing contractor's marketing agent sent the electronic spreadsheet to a job prospect as part of a skills test. The applicant then sought, so this is more than we knew the last time, the applicant then sought help by unwittingly posted the confidential data on a tutoring website. This is where you wish every building had brick walls, so you could bang your head against them. Do you guys get the process here? Stanford Hospital provides services, wants to send out bills, hires a billing company which then takes the patient information, name, date, illness, treatment, whatever, puts it into a spreadsheet. The billing company hires a marketing agent. To, I guess, understand its services. Hey, marketing agent, just to have a better sense of what we do so you could go pitch our services, here is a spreadsheet containing data we get from one of our clients. Marketing agent needs employees. Looking for someone who can handle spreadsheets. Hey, kid, you think you can handle this one? Here, let's see what you can do with it. We want to see it in charts. Bar graphs, I guess pie charts rather. The job candidate doesn't know spreadsheets, doesn't know how to do this, goes on to a tutoring site and says, I have this spreadsheet. Here it is. Can someone help me turn it into a pie chart? How many different lapses can you count in that one incident? One can assume that the hospital has a contract with the billing contractor, which most likely, it's Stanford Hospital, probably a pretty sophisticated place, includes business associates requirements. The billing contractor then hires a marketing company and hands off the data, maybe under a confidentiality agreement, maybe not, which then hands it off to an employee, a potential employee who's probably not under any contract, and posts it to the web. And the poor schlub who got treatment at this hospital has his, you know, really embarrassing tattoo removal surgery everywhere. Oh, by the way, pressed for time, the job prospect wound up completing the assignment herself and in the end did not get hired. This is what, you can't do anything with this. This is where we have to understand the limits of law. Right? In this context, there is significant statute and statutory and regulatory guidance. This is not Article 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act. Right? The FTC has jurisdiction over fraud and misrepresentation. No. This is, if you have personally identifiable health information, you must treat it this way, store it in this way, limit access to these people, only use it for this and this and that purpose, and if you're sharing it, do so under these contracts. They may have done all of that, but you can't legislate against stupid. So what do you do, future lawyers, in considering, let's say you are counseling your client, the hospital, and it is, why? This might be a good exam type question. See how this works? You are the lawyer for a hospital. The hospital is considering hiring a company to help it better understand its treatment results. What are you going to advise your client with regard to its obligations? Go. What are you going to advise your client? What's the first thing you're going to advise your client? What's the easy, low-hanging fruit here? What does it have to know about? HIPAA, thank you. Okay, you've just gotten your B. If you don't mention HIPAA, you're not getting a B on this question. Let's see you push it up. What else do you have to advise your client about? What about HIPAA? What does HIPAA require? Privacy and security. There's your B and a half. This is a contractor. What else does HIPAA require? What did HIPAA require the pharmacist to have, pharmacy to have with the lawyer? A business associate agreement. Good, you're in the B plus range. Now what? What else are you going to advise your client, thinking about this story in particular, about the risks it faces? Well, if I were writing that exam question, I would point out to my client that whatever it does with the contracts, once it releases those data to a third party, it has no way of controlling them. And the third party could release it, at best being embarrassing to the hospital, at worst, setting it up for HIPAA violation, potentially lawsuits from patients whose data were breached. So what do you advise the hospital to do if it's going to be working with this contractor to try to evaluate its practices? what should the hospital do before providing the information to this contractor in order to reduce the worries about data breach? What doesn't a contractor need if it's going to be evaluating the type and success of treatments?
Names.
Names. The billing vendor needed names here. The marketing vendor did not. The marketing vendor was being asked to essentially analyze the types of services the billing vendor was doing. But the marketing vendor here didn't take the moment, sorry, the billing contractor did not bother to anonymize the data, which left it open for negligent sharing, for being released. So you advise your client that both as required by HIPAA, which says essentially, unless it's necessary, you always anonymize the data. If the question, as written, does not require names on it, you advise your client to take away personally identifiable information. And to get that A on the exam, you point out it's not just names. It may be blood types or other sorts of information that can be combined to identify individuals before providing, and it needs the contracts, and might want to check its insurance to make sure it's covered for these sorts of things anyway. And now you've got your A on this question. Based only on the kinds of things we discussed in class today, I want you to think about these things as a risk management. That makes sense to you guys? If you're starting to think about exams, that's the kind of question I will be asking you. That might be an exact question. I haven't written it yet. I might forget. You will be given a situation. There will be probably, you'll be able to figure out the context. I might be asking you to figure out the context. Oh, it's health, but there are other information here too. And then you'll be asked, answer a question. Write a letter to a client. Advise on risks. What kinds of provisions have to go into a contract? Something like that. The B answer, my basically acceptable grade is in the BB minus range. If you start getting things wrong, it drops. But the B answer is, you figure out this is a HIPAA question, and you basically talk about protecting health information. Okay. BB minus. But the more correct things you put on top of that to show that you're thinking like a lawyer and you're answering the question, the better the grade will be on that portion of the exam. So you may have hospitals, getting back to where things go horribly wrong, you may have hospitals that do the right thing but their contractors don't. You may have hospitals where the employees of the hospitals don't do the right thing. July 8th of this year, the UCLA health system has agreed to pay $865,500 as part of a settlement with federal regulators, that means a HIPAA violation, announced Thursday after two celebrity patients alleged that hospital employees broke the law and reviewed their medical records without authorization. Federal and hospital officials declined to identify the celebrities involved. Apparently, in Hollywood, you know, a star comes into the hospital, some hospital employee for curiosity or maybe to send it to TMZ, gets access to the records in a way that's not about health care. Two patients, $865,000 fine. UCLA. That was, of course, 3 years after the breaches were first disclosed, it says here. The violations led state legislators to pass a law imposing escalating fines on hospitals for patient privacy lapses. So, federal law makes requirements, but the state law supplements that with penalties in California. Probably, like California has stronger protection of celebrities and their identities from theft and from right to publicity, California Hollywood area has more than its share of celebrity patients and the doctors who mistreat them and get convicted of involuntary manslaughter and things like that. Questions on the ideas here of data protection so far? All right. Let's spend just a couple of minutes setting out some of the other legal issues here. And really, if you've taken con law, they're not unfamiliar to you. The requirements of substantive due process, constitutional right to privacy. Of course, there is no right to privacy explicit in the Constitution, but it has developed. So, substantive due process, when it comes to health, back in 1891, in a railway employee case, or railway case, the court was not allowed to compel a plaintiff in a civil action to have surgery. The bodily integrity of that person overruled the potential needs in the case. I'm not asking you to read these cases. These are really setting the stage for where government intrusion into personal decisions is limited by the due process rights and the other things that become the right to privacy. The compulsion to attend public school. Right? The law could not mandate public schools. You can mandate education, but not the type of education. And then we get into the really very cogent health-related privacy matters. Griswold, 1965, banning contraception, beginning this discussion of this zone of privacy. Another contraceptive case in Eisenstadt versus Baird. And then, of course, Roe versus Wade. The right of a woman to choose whether or not to terminate her pregnancy, at least at a point where the fetus is not viable on its own. I hope you were hearing the news this week that, where was it? Was it Alabama? I think it was Alabama. Or Mississippi, I'm going to get this wrong. A very conservative state this week was asked to vote to define personhood. You may have heard that phrase in the news. Personhood, beginning at the time that an egg is fertilized. And it was pointed out that definition would not only have essentially turned voluntary abortion into potential manslaughter or murder, but would also have put at risk the ability to legally purchase many forms of contraception, which, like for example, the birth control pill, which does not block fertilization but implantation of the fertilized egg in the uterus, would have required criminal investigations for things like ectopic pregnancies, where they were termination post-fertilization. That amendment, that request for changing the law, was defeated. But it gets back to these same discussions of the bodily integrity when it comes to reproductive rights and where how you define privacy in terms of the ability to either undergo or to not undergo a medical procedure, the ability to control one's body. And there's some of these other cases. This one's interesting. This is not a medical case per se, in the sense that this was not about medical treatment. This was about data. It's an early case, and I'll get you the citation. I should have had it here. Which had to do with state records on drug use and whether those records could or could not be released. The court is not unaware. This was about an early case about computer records and health privacy, and they did not get to this question about the need, the legal requirement for security. But even then, and this case goes back, I think, either to the late 70s or early 80s, I apologize, I will get you the citation. Even then, just as Brandeis and Warren in the right to privacy were seeing technology changing things, here too, in the concurrence, I'm not prepared to say that future developments will demonstrate the necessity of some curve on such technology. How that parses. There might be a knot missing there. But the court at that point declined to put in place formal obligations on data protection. We now know they're there in the case of HIPAA. So, in addition to these questions of general health information, we have situations where the particular disclosure has consequences. It's not just the general harm of disclosure of health information, but rather that because of what was disclosed to whom, there are other consequences. One of those contexts, one of those situations, has to do with disclosure of HIV positive status, particularly in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, when transmission was not well understood, there were no effective antiviral treatments, and being exposed, if that's the right word, as being HIV positive carried with it serious stigma. So there's this case, Doe versus Borough of Barrington, which is this really sort of strange case having to do with a car accident that went through a fence, and then people ended up at the police station. And in the course of this investigation, it was leaked that someone in a family in the town was HIV positive. This chain of facts is odd, but that's really what this is. And the question was whether that disclosure by a police officer violated the privacy rights of the plaintiff, Doe, right away. You could see that. And as a result, by the way, of the disclosure, there were issues with the kids at school, there were issues at the neighborhood, there were real-world consequences, and yes, the District of New Jersey found in 1990, this disclosure by this detective, which was really a casual disclosure, was not related to health care, violated the plaintiff's privacy rights. In another case in Philadelphia, having to do with a transit worker who was HIV positive, who had disclosed that to an in-house benefits person, and then there were questions of the cost of treatment, and that benefits person then shared it with someone else in the company, and it was, why is this a federal case? Because it was a public transit agency and therefore a government agency, constitutional protection. Here, disclosure of prescription drug records for the purposes of monitoring health plans, in particular disclosure of the use of Retrovir, one of those situations where they did not say someone in the company has HIV/AIDS, but someone in the company was using the company's health plan to purchase antiviral drugs whose only main use was in the treatment of HIV. It was an effective disclosure. But that disclosure was not considered a constitutional violation because he had already told people within the company. So it wasn't that the disclosure was proper, but it did not add harm in this case. I realize I'm raising this only as an example of the type of situation that comes up when you have sensitive health information that is disclosed and the consequences, and when it's done by a governmental official, there are clear potential constitutional violations. And finally, genetics. Health information that is literally the information we're based on. Your DNA. Who owns it? Who controls it? Who is permitted to use it? As we get more sophisticated as a society in understanding DNA coding and being able to read it, identify particular genes and their health consequences, having access to DNA data is not just about personal identity, because it is. Watch any CSI episode, you'll know that. But it can also be about disclosing health information, predilection for certain diseases, genetic diseases that are already there, so on. The FBI in the States 2 years ago were vastly expanding their DNA databases for criminal investigations. What about the rights of that? And then we get to the Moore case. This is a really strange case. Moore had, I think, squashy cell leukemia. Very rare, unusual cancer. Moore's spleen was removed. Moore was treated, but the hospital kept the spleen and used it to culture an entire cell line, which it then sold to other health providers. Moore brought a lawsuit. Or Moore could. So what kind of causes of action? One thing was whether there was a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty. Did the hospital owe him a duty as its patient to disclose this and potentially to give him the right to consent? Maybe. Conversion. It's conversion. What is the tort of conversion? Anybody know? It's not about religion. Right. So here, there was no conversion found. It wasn't deemed to be his personal property, his cell line taken from his spleen. There was a cause of action at least stated for lack of informed consent. And there was a dissent that suggested that there was a conversion. And some others had argued generally. But think about this. And there was another case, I know it was in the Times Magazine within the last 6 months, about some woman whose cells have become just this huge industry. So here's my final question, folks. Who owns you? What? That is the answer of the evening. Absolutely. Questions, thoughts, comments, concerns, squeamishness?
Well,
All right. Have a good night.
Thank you.